this joint committee of land.
We're all here. We're three of us are here.
Yeah, there's we've actually got a quorum of the Senate Ag and Natural Resources Committee. It's the other committee that's not.
It's the Land and Water Committee.
It's not quite a quorum at this point. But whatever we're doing, we're together.
They're not used to getting up this early.
Yeah, they're used to 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
We'll hope for good things from the rest of our committee members, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're here this morning. I think this will be a very educational time. And since Senator Farioli did the work of getting this together, I'm going to let him kind of take it and run with it. And the agenda's pretty much in front of us. Senator Farioli?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I will convene a subcommittee of the Land and Water Committee.
Of yourself, huh?
Exactly.
Okay.
A number of representatives and senators serve on the Hanford Waste Cleanup Board, which is organized through the Oregon Office of Energy. And as part of the Oregon Hanford Waste Board's orientation, we get, as members of that committee, we've been made aware of some facts that a lot of Oregonians perhaps have forgotten over the years. And it's just a really important element of membership of that Oregon State Hanford Waste Cleanup Board is to reach out to other legislators and to the members of the community so that people are aware of the whole situation at Hanford, the radiologically and chemically hazardous wastes that are stored there, the danger, how long the danger will last and what's the extent of the danger, and the cleanup effort. And those things are definitely of effect to Oregon citizens. First of all, virtually everybody in the state of Oregon at one point or another is downwind. The operation at Hanford has largely been a matter of national security and secrecy until relatively recently when large numbers of documents have been declassified. As a result of the declassification, it's been disclosed to citizens that of the 586 square miles that constitute the Hanford site, many of those areas are contaminated with chemicals and radioactive materials consisting of about 54 million gallons of highly radioactive waste that at one point in time was stored in 177 above ground tanks. Only a few of those that are actually double walled. Most of them were constructed in the 40s and early 50s. At the time they were constructed, they had a maximum 40-year half-life. So a number of those have failed. There are millions of gallons of radioactive material that's leaked into the water, into the groundwater. There are hundreds of millions of gallons potentially contaminated water moving into the Columbia River at this point, and have been in the past and will into the future. The estimate currently is that there's 100 square miles of groundwater contamination on the Hanford Reservation, so a fifth of the area is now thoroughly contaminated in terms of groundwater. The cleaning up of the Hanford complex is a commitment that boggles the imagination in terms of time. When we discussed the issues of half-life with the engineers that were there on site giving us orientation, I think it is amazing to folks to consider that we're going to have radioactivity on the Hanford site for not just thousands of years or tens of thousands of years, but literally for millions of years. I don't know if those consequences were thoroughly reviewed or considered at the time that the technologies were developed to develop nuclear materials and nuclear weapons. But certainly now that we've looked at those situations, it's clear that currently there are no technologies that exist to clean up Hanford waste. There are some technologies that will mitigate it and some that will help us gain control of the waste stream. But currently there's no real good technology for what we consider to be a full shutdown, a full cleanup of the Hanford facility. I just think it's really important that legislators take an active role in this. Oregon has no official standing when it comes to the tripartite agreement. our citizens are exposed to radiation, our citizens share the Columbia River, our citizens were exposed to intentional releases of radiation that were done for strategic and military research during the Cold War. We will share in the ultimate cost of the cleanup, and certainly we'll have our share of the disease and cancers and other negative consequences resulting from the leakage of radiation from the site. But it's also our responsibility to try to educate Oregon citizens, the Oregon congressional delegation, Oregon legislators, to try to be more active and more insistent about the cleanup of the Hanford nuclear waste dump. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I just would suggest that today's informational meeting is just that, an attempt to get the word to yet another generation of Oregonians who may not have been aware of the race for nuclear weapons fueled by the World War II, the Cold War buildup of nuclear weaponry on a global scale, the eventual ending of the Cold War and turning away from the theories of mutually assured destruction that built nuclear arsenals to irrational proportions in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union and other countries. And now, again, we're confronting an era where nuclear weaponry is coming center stage in the world theater of politics. It's time that we remind ourselves that there's an aftermath that may be as serious as the actual use of atomic weapons, and that's what do you do to clean up the sites where they're manufactured. So that introduction, rather lengthy, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask you to go ahead and conduct the meeting and have the briefing from the folks that have come here to tell Oregonians about the cleanup efforts at Hanford.
Great. First on our list this morning, of course, is Michael Greeney, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. We're glad you're here this morning. Mike, why don't you just lead off?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Greeney, Director of the Office of Energy. And I will be very brief. I just want to give a brief overview of what you'll hear from the panels this morning. Senator Ferrioli very eloquently stated the problem of Hanford and the risks that it poses to Oregonians. And while there has been some progress in some specific areas of cleanup, so much more needs to be done, and many issues are unresolved. Ken Niles, who's with me here at the panel, he's the administrator of our Nuclear Safety Division. He'll give you an overview of both the current situation at Hanford and some of the key issues that are of concern to us. Our next speaker, Armand Minthorn, is a member of the Board of Directors of the Tribes of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. The Confederated Tribes are an important ally for us as a sovereign government. They have independent treaty rights that have been abrogated at Hanford, and we fully support their efforts to get those treaty rights restored. Armand's also a member on our Hanford Waste Board. And that Hanford Waste Board is a citizens and legislative panel that provides direction and oversight and advice to the Office of Energy and ultimately to the governor on Hanford issues. To give you more perspective on the Waste Board's perspective, we have the chairman of the Waste Board, Shelley Simone, this morning, who came over from LeGrand, and with her, Norma Jean Germond, another board member, and both of those members recently acknowledged for their 15 years of service on the board. It's a lot of dedication to the Hanford issues that I think all our board members demonstrate. Doug Riggs, who represents the Hanford Information Network, that is one of a number of our citizens groups that are very involved and active in Hanford. We do have some very active and I think very important citizens groups that have been involved, and that's been important for us to help educate people and I think to get the attention of the federal government and the state of Washington on issues that are important to Oregon. Finally, while she's not on any of the panels. I wanted to acknowledge that we have in the audience today Marilyn Reeves, who was for a long time the chair of the regional Hanford Advisory Board, which is a very important board advising the U.S. Department of Energy, and her role as an Oregonian on that board has been very important for us. And lastly, if time permits, if the chair's wish, we can discuss briefly legislation that the committee is will be considering on Hanford. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to turn it over to Ken Niles.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to start this off with a very brief background about Hanford and explain a little bit about how we got to where we are today in terms of the waste problem. There has been, despite what you may read, a little bit of progress at Hanford in terms of cleanup, and I would like to focus on a couple of the most major recent achievements that we've seen at Hanford. But Hanford being Hanford, we still have a lot of concerns about the direction of cleanup on some very important issues, and I'd like to highlight a few of those as well. I have a few photos and maps, and Patricia, if you could start us off there with the Columbia River, which of course is the main reason that Oregon is involved with Hanford, the main reason we have concern about the direction of cleanup at Hanford. If you look at the map showing the Hanford site, you can see that the Columbia River, of course, flows through the Hanford site, then becomes our border with Washington State. The Hanford site, as Senator Ferraioli mentioned, is quite large, 586 square miles. It covers a great deal of land and desert land for the most part in south-central Washington State. Its origins date back actually to World War II. It was part of the Manhattan Project, the super-secret project to develop nuclear weapons. And plutonium created in Hanford was used in the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, Japan, that helped put an end to World War II. Following the end of the Second World War, over the next 18 or 20 years, Hanford went through several major expansions. And eventually, the federal government built 9 nuclear production reactors, 5 huge chemical separations buildings, such as this one, over 1,000 feet in length, huge concrete and steel structures. Hundreds of support facilities built at the Hanford site over these 20 or 30 years. The peak of operations at Hanford was really about 1960, the late 1950s, early 1960s. At some points, all 9 reactors in operation, Hanford churning out huge amounts of plutonium during this time. Beginning in about 1964, the federal government began to scale back operations at Hanford, shutting down 1 reactor a year. Until about 1972, they had just 1 reactor operating. And Hanford continued at lesser levels of operations through the 70s, increased production in the 80s during the Reagan administration's buildup of our nuclear weapons program. And then in 1988, production in Hanford shut down when the federal government realized that the Cold War was over and the United States was, as someone quoted at the time, awash in plutonium. The process to produce plutonium creates huge amounts of both chemically and radioactively contaminated waste. And at Hanford, production was always the priority. Waste management was never well funded, and in some cases was never well thought out at Hanford. Huge amounts of liquid waste were disposed into the ground. At one time in the early 1990s, they estimated that amount being 444 billion gallons of liquids disposed into the ground at Hanford. This is one of the reactor facilities at Hanford. That Z-shaped trench near the bottom was a liquid waste disposal trench. That's more than 1,000 feet in length, so you can get an idea of the scale and certainly the proximity to the Columbia River. Senator Ferraioli mentioned the groundwater contamination at Hanford. The shaded areas there do show the groundwater contamination plumes. These are above regulatory limits, both a variety of chemical and radioactive materials. It's well over 100 square miles of Hanford that has contaminated the groundwater. Some of that groundwater is reaching the Columbia River. The most contaminated, the most highly radioactive materials were put into underground tanks at Hanford. You can see this is some of the waste inside the tanks. It ranges in consistency from liquids to nearly concrete in terms of its consistency. This was put into underground tanks as they went along. At Hanford, available tank space was always an issue. They were always seeming to be stretched thin in terms of their ability to store additional waste as production went on. So the answer for the most part was to build more tanks. And they continued constructing tanks over the next 30 or 40 years at Hanford until eventually they had 149 of these single shell tanks, just a single thin layer of carbon steel embedded in concrete, to hold the waste at Hanford. Unfortunately, by the mid-1950s, they realized some of these tanks were leaking. And despite that, they continued to use these tanks. They continued to put waste into these tanks. But they also at some point realized they needed a better tank. So they began to construct double wall tanks. And during the 1970s into the mid-1980s, they constructed 28 additional double shell tanks, all more than 1 million gallons in size. So if we look at the Hanford tanks overall, and this is an aerial view because these are underground tanks, and this shows just 8 of the tanks and the risers and the surface features. At Hanford, they have 177 underground storage tanks, currently holding about 53 million gallons of very highly radioactive liquid waste. 67 of these tanks are known to have leaked. The tanks is the most serious problem, but there are other many problems at Hanford. These two reactor facilities, the K-East and K-West reactors, again, you can see the proximity to the Columbia River. Inside each of these buildings are underground or underwater storage pools that store, until recently, more than 2,000 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel, very highly radioactive fuel. These basins have leaked in the past. It has been a priority for the state of Oregon to get this spent fuel removed from these reactor basins and moved away from the Columbia River. There are also at Hanford hundreds, not dozens, hundreds of burial grounds, many of which they still do not really fully understand the type and extent of the waste that was disposed into the soil at Hanford. Two of the burial grounds that they're planning on remediating sometime in the next 15 years or so, they're not in any hurry to do these, are expected to cost about $400 million just to clean up these two of the many hundreds of burial grounds at Hanford. There are also many tons of plutonium at Hanford in a variety of different chemical forms. There are a variety of stabilization techniques that need to be done at Hanford before this plutonium can be stored with any comfort for any length of time. There are contaminated laboratories, contaminated hot cells at Hanford. Overall, they estimate that there are more than 1,500 different waste sites at Hanford. And obviously, there isn't time to talk about all 1,500 today. We're only going to focus on a few. I mentioned production ended at Hanford in 1988. Cleanup is really considered to have begun in 1989 with the signing of the tri-party agreement between the state of Washington, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the U.S. Department of Energy. Cleanup at Hanford was really very slow to start, and even though the agreement set forth a number of milestones and deadlines by which cleanup should occur, it really took several years to get things underway. There was a lot of identification of the problem, a lot of analysis of how best to remediate the problem, and really into the mid-1990s, you could not really look at Hanford and say any cleanup had been accomplished. Since that time, however, we have seen some progress, and that's the end of the pictures I wanted to show to you as I talk just about a couple of other things. Let me focus on two of the cleanup successes at Hanford, because there have been some successes. Less than 5 years ago, the Hanford site manager was called before a congressional committee, which was investigating why one of the most important projects at Hanford, and this was to remove the spent fuel from those two reactor basins from the river, why that project had completely come off track. Schedules were completely unrealistic. The budget was seemingly doubling every other month, and there seemed to be no chance whatsoever that this would successfully be done. It was technically a very complex, very difficult project to do. Federal government wasn't really committed to doing it at that point, and it showed because there was no progress to speak of. Earlier this year, the federal government announced that more than half of that spent fuel has now successfully been moved away from the Columbia River. During those 5 years, they designed techniques, equipment, procedures, They overcame a lot of obstacles. They committed themselves in terms of the funding to do this. And within the next year or two, we should see the completion of this project and all of the spent fuel moved away from the Columbia River into, again, not clean up as you would think of cleaned up, but into much safer storage condition, away from the Columbia River, out of those leaking basins. The lesson here for us, I think, as we look at some of the accomplishments at Hanford, the lesson here is this became a priority for everyone. Became a priority finally for the U.S. Department of Energy after Congress got on them. It was a priority for the regulators, for the state of Oregon, for the Native American tribes, for the citizen groups. And the U.S. Department of Energy dedicated the resources, the funds, the technical expertise to overcome some very difficult challenges. And so I think for us, as we look at some of these other projects at Hanford that are very technically difficult at this point to get a grasp on, we can look to this project and see, yes, if you dedicate the resources, if you dedicate the funding, it can be done. Another major accomplishment at Hanford is not really a cleanup per se, but it's removing the threat of more contamination, and that's moving the liquid waste out of the older tanks into the newer tanks, into the double shell tanks, none of which have leaked as of yet. About that same time frame, 5 years or so ago, the state of Washington was just about ready to take the federal government to court to force the federal government to continue with pumping the liquids out of these tanks. It was a project, again, technically difficult, very expensive. The federal government was not at all enamored of dedicating its resources to this project. But it was an important thing to do because it gets those liquid wastes into better confinement. At the last minute, they resolved the legal dispute. Federal government agreed to a court-ordered sanction to continue with this work. And just earlier this year, they have successfully reached the 2.5 million gallon mark out of 3 million total in terms of pumping these liquids. And again, within the next year, this project will be complete. And the lesson here for us is that sometimes it takes a prod, it takes the threat of legal action or some other type of stick hanging over their heads to get the federal government to move forward at Hanford cleanup. Let me mention briefly three concerns we have remaining at Hanford. And again, with 1,500 waste sites, we can't talk about all the progress and all the concerns. I talked a lot about the tank waste, the 177 tanks, 53 million gallons of waste. Getting it out of the tanks and getting it somehow solidified is really the key to Hanford cleanup. The waste will still be, even in a treated form, will still be highly radioactive, but it will be out of those aging, leaking tanks, and it will be solidified so it can't move around in the environment. The technology to do this is called vitrification, and what it involves is mixing the waste with glass-making materials, making a molten glass, pouring it into stainless steel canisters where it will harden. Again, the waste is still highly radioactive, but it would be out of the environment, out of the ground, out of these aging tanks. This has been, for many years, the thing everyone has hoped for to see at Hanford is the construction and operation of vitrification facilities. Over the years, we've seen about three attempts that have come up, that have started, that have failed. We're in the process now where we have some optimism. Construction began on these facilities last year. There is a lot of progress being made in terms of the design and construction of these facilities. We're still looking 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now before we see full-scale operation of these facilities, maybe 15 years before we see even 10% of the waste treated. The concern we have is keeping this project on track. Again, our thought, the thought of Oregon, the thought of the regulators for many years has been the waste in the tanks will be vitrified. Federal government in the past year or so has really begun to kind of hedge from that. They've said, well, we'll still vitrify the most highly radioactive of the waste, but the lower activity, and now they're talking more than half of the waste, they're talking about using some other, what they're calling supplemental technologies, and they're counting on these technologies panning out. And as yet, they still haven't even done the full testing of these technologies. We don't have any confidence yet that these supplemental technologies will put the waste into a solid environment like the vitrification in the glass. In the past few months, we've heard of engineering difficulties, design difficulties with the vitrification facilities. That, in all likelihood, is going to delay construction and operation by a year or more. So we're in the process of maybe getting a fix on the biggest problem at Hanford, but things aren't going quite the way we'd like to see them. Another issue at Hanford that causes us concern is groundwater contamination. Oregon has really been in the forefront, really since the mid-1980s, in trying to focus attention of the regulators and the federal government on groundwater contamination and remediation. We've had some successes over the years. In the past year, actually, we've seen probably more discussion of groundwater contamination in Hanford than we've seen in the past 10 years. But at the moment, so far, it's all just been talk. It's been planning. It's been raising the visibility of this issue. But we really haven't seen an increase in terms of actual remediation, in terms of treatment, in terms of a real approach towards resolving this problem. So that remains one of our ongoing concerns as well. And I know Shelley Simone will talk a little bit more as well about groundwater and the importance for us. Third issue I want to highlight of concern is the amount of waste that is going to go to Hanford over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years for disposal. 3 years ago, the U.S. Department of Energy named Hanford as one of two national disposal sites for low-level and mixed low-level radioactive waste from throughout the Department of Energy complex nationwide. We don't yet know the quantities of waste. It may be in the tens of thousands of truckloads. We don't know what impacts that would have in disposal at Hanford. We don't know the impacts that disposing of waste at Hanford over the past 50 years fully has had on the environment at Hanford, and the Department of Energy has really not done an adequate job so far in terms of assessing the impact on the Hanford site. The transportation impacts is one area that we do believe we have a fairly good handle on. We have been very actively involved with training emergency responders throughout the entire state of Oregon since the early 1980s. We've provided them with radiation detection equipment, training exercises, and what this number will probably surprise you, but since 1982, we have seen more than 15,000 truckloads of radioactive material travel through the state of Oregon. We have had 6 incidents involving those shipments. None has resulted in any spillage of radioactive materials. We work very closely with the local governments in terms of preparation. We work closely with the other western states in working with the U.S. Department of Energy to ensure certain safeguards for these trucks of waste as they travel through the state. So those are some of the issues that are out ahead of us that will take a lot of effort yet to see their resolution. Senator Ferry only mentioned this is an issue that is going to be ongoing for the next many decades as we see what transpires at Hanford. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or we can go to the next speaker.
Are there any questions right now? Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Herman Minthorn is next on our schedule, and I'd like to welcome you here this morning, Herman, from the Confederated Tribes. Would you introduce yourself for the record? Thank you for coming.
My name is Armand Minthorn. I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes Umatilla Board of Trustees, our governing body. First, I want to thank the committee for allowing this time. I think it's important today that what you hear and what you see, I hope you can remember. This is a very big concern. The past administration with Governor Kitzhaber cited this as a priority, Hanford issues. I would hope that this committee could maintain that vigilance and that priority with this new administration with Governor-elect Kulongowski. On behalf of the Umatilla tribes, too, I want to thank you for allowing this time. You know, as information and as education for this committee, I would hope that there would be some continued support for government-to-government with tribes in the state of Oregon. Governor Kitzhaber, through the SB 770, reaffirmed the importance of government-to-government with tribes, and I would hope that this committee as well could forward that recommendation. Being that the tribes are a sovereign nation, we have a lot of interest in preservation and protection of cultural resources and economic heritage, both within the boundaries of the Umatilla Reservation and the tribe's ceded areas and Aboriginal use. The Treaty of 1855 between the United States government and the tribes specifically reserved rights and interests to lands and natural resources outside the Umatilla Indian Reservation, including but not limited to the ceded area in the United States and to the usual and accustomed fishing sites in the Columbia Basin. The CTYR ceded territory includes a large portion of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Hanford continues to be a major toxic threat to the Columbia River and the region, and the CTYR tribal goals envision for the Hanford end state continues to be one of a clean and functioning ecology safe for children and wildlife. The Columbia River is perhaps the most significant cultural and natural resource in the Pacific Northwest. Any threat to its health is a direct threat to resources significant to the tribes and citizens of the state of Oregon. CTYR participation in Hanford cleanup efforts is based on the following primary objectives: protection of tribal sovereignty, including protection of tribal rights in CTYR ceded territory and areas over which the CTYR exercises off-reservation rights; protection and restoration of the environment, both on the Hanford site and in infected areas by Hanford over which CTYR exercises off-reservation treaty rights; protection of cultural, religious, and archaeological resources and the tribes' rights related to them; protection of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and its members and residents from hazards caused by Hanford activities and from hazards caused by transportation of radioactive and hazardous materials to and from Hanford. The current areas of focus for the tribes in Hanford cleanup include risks and impacts of vadose zone and groundwater contamination on the Columbia River, the adequacy and residual risk of the 100K area, the cleanup enclosure plans in other areas, the risk and impacts of airborne contaminants on natural and cultural resources at Hanford, and the interaction of near-surface soil contamination on terrestrial ecology and food chain. Since 1994, the tribes and the state of Oregon have continued in a memorandum of agreement. The intent of our agreement is to coordinate on Hanford-related projects of mutual interest where possible. Topics of mutual interest identified in the MOU are protection of the Columbia River and groundwater, transportation of radioactive hazardous chemical materials, emergency preparedness, and public involvement. In light of this testimony, I would hope that in recognizing the importance of what is done at Hanford, most important, the environment, we have citizens in the state of Oregon, we have citizens within the state of Washington, we have threats to our environment, and these threats do not recognize Indian or non-Indian. these threats have to be taken very seriously, Mr. Chairman. And I would anticipate, as from the past administration, Governor Kitzhaber opposed the restart of the FastFlux test facility, I would recommend that this committee continue this position with Governor Kulongowski. The threat from the restarting of FastFlux is very significant, not only to the environment, but also because of restarting the FastFlux, it would also create more hazardous radioactive material. I would also recommend to this committee and urge recommendations on passing the joint resolution. Through this resolution, I believe the state of Oregon and tribes can be vigilant and hold accountable Department of Energy and the cleanup that it does at Hanford. We have a responsibility, us as parents and as grandparents, to our future generations. My old people at home are very worried and scared because of what is happening to the Hanford Reach. We know that there are contaminants that are reaching the Hanford Reach. The state of Oregon has acknowledged the Columbia River as a priority. The Hanford Reach is the last remaining spawning area. I urge this committee and I urge the state of Oregon to team and to hold vigilance with the Department of Energy so that they can be accountable for what they do at Hanford. I know my children and my grandchildren have expectations of me. Your children and grandchildren are no different. Me and you, we depend on this environment. Sometimes we take too much for granted. My old people tell me at home, one even held up a picture of a salmon. Is this how it's going to be 50 years from now? Our great-great-grandchildren, is this all they're going to see in our rivers, is a picture of a salmon? That's what they're scared of. Sometimes we take too much for granted the water that we drink out of these jugs. You and I depend on the same environment. Our resources are not expendable. That's why we have to hold Department of Energy accountable to mitigate impacts to our resources that we depend on, that our future generations are going to be dependent on. Our resources have to be clean. I urge, again, this committee to take these into mind and build a memory so that we, as the state of Oregon and tribes, can hold Department of Energy accountable for what they do and what they don't do. But I urge again this committee, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this time. And I truly believe that the information you hear today, that you as a committee will take action. I have expectations of you to do something with what you hear. And that would be one of my questions, Mr. Chairman. At the end of this hearing, I would ask, what will you do with this information that you hear? That would be my question to you. But again, I thank you for this time. And if there's any questions or comments, I would truly appreciate. Thank you.
Armin, thank you for coming. Are there questions that you have?
Mr. Chairman, I may have a question. I just want to express the fact that having served with Mr. Minthorn on this committee for about the last 5 years, that I've appreciated his diligence and commitment to educating people about the issues at Hanford. And we're spending, in Oregon and Washington, literally hundreds of millions in salmon restoration. And under the power administration is doing mitigation and restoration spending in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Yet we're allowing radioactive water, radioactive contamination to enter the groundwater and to enter the Columbia River, knowing that the Salmonid species are particularly susceptible to radioactivity. And it just seems like we're, you know, we really don't have a very well-coordinated approach to the cleanup issues and the threat recognition. So, you know, we're apparently doing all we can to mitigate negative effects on salmon. At the same time, we're poisoning them in the home reaches of the Columbia Basin. It just seems a little illogical to me.
It seems like a good definition of insanity to me.
Well, we can talk about the whole issue of nuclear weapons. We developed nuclear weapons in wartime and in the Cold War. The cleanup needs to have the moral equivalency of war, and at times it does not. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, one of the messages here today is how committed are we to cleaning up the mess?
I have a lot of questions in my head, and one is this is ceded territory, and there's treaty rights to ceded territory, and yet I would assume you can't even go on to this ceded territory inside the Hanford Reservation anymore because it's
contaminated.
That seems like an incredible inconsistency in itself. You know, that's a violation. At one level, that's a violation of treaty rights. Has there ever been any kind of talk between lawyers around that particular point?
This is a very sensitive area with tribes, but also with the Department of Energy. Our attorneys have discussed this matter, and because tribes are what is called a natural trustee, because we retain treaty rights within the ceded area, and within the Hanford Reservation, this is one element that tribes have held very strong with the Department of Energy to mitigate any risk or elevating risk to environment and or resources. Our attorneys have advised that in the event we do litigate with Department of Energy, our data has to be there to support our litigation so that we can look and have the data to support our treaty resources. But I think the arena of litigation is very sensitive, and we are considering some options that we have.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you for coming this morning. I want to continue this conversation, and certainly Senator Farioli is probably the chairman of the committee that will receive the bill once it's out of draft form, in a form that can be acted upon in committee unless we decide to have the joint committee meet again. I certainly personally intend to respond, and I hope the Senate and the legislature as a whole will do so.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've in years past have found that this is one of those memorials that gets a unanimous vote from both houses.
Yep.
So I would anticipate a similar vote. But we will take action. As a matter of fact, it will be on the president's desk for first reading this morning. So I'll start through the process today.
And as a final note, Mr. Chairman, if there's... I would offer my assistance to yourself to give a presentation to the Senate on Hanford Matters, whatever that could be worth, but I would offer my assistance.
Okay, thank you. At this point, I'm going to...
Should I invite both?
Okay. Yeah, Shelley Simone and Norma Jean Germond, who are both members of the Oregon Hanford Waste Board, to come up and share with us. You can go in either order. I'll let you decide.
Thank you. I guess I'm up first.
You know, I'll let you hand this out, Tricia.
I want to thank both Senator Shields and Senator Farioli for giving us this time to talk about Hanford. It has consumed the Simone household for the past 16 years, and my 13-year-old son feels like he has a stepbrother in Hanford. I often tease him that I'll bequeath my seat on this board to him, and that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but also terribly sad fact. This site will not be cleaned up for many, many years. My name is Shelley Simone. I live out in eastern Oregon. I live in the Grand Ronde Valley, in the city of La Grande. We're bounded by a very deep canyon called Land Canyon on one side, and the beautiful Blue Mountains, which are quite treacherous in the winter months when it is snowing. I want to talk a little bit about the board, a little bit about our history, the convening of it, some of our accomplishments, and then also speak to a few issues that are important to our board as we move forward in the next year's work. Our board was convened in 1986 by Governor Goldschmidt. And at that time, there was the Oregon Hanford Waste Board was only a legislative board. It had an ancillary committee called the Hanford Advisory Committee, which was made up of, I think, 16 seats. I've gone down into the basement of my house back to the archives to take a look, and I believe there were 16 of us on that original committee that did the legwork to help support the advice and recommendations that came from the Oregon Hanford Waste Board. When Barbara Roberts became governor, she decided to streamline this board and combined the committee of citizens and the legislative body into one board, and that was in 1991. It was interesting to go back and listen to read what Neil Goldschmidt said in his mandate to the board in 1986. He said, "I will hold the board responsible for building a fire under citizens and decision makers, including me and Oregon's congressional delegation, to make an irreversible beginning." And I think of irreversible beginning and believe that that is the mandate that we still carry with us to this day as a board. Our mission is to focus on Oregon's concerns and interests in the cleanup at Hanford. We focus on protection of the Columbia River. We focus on the transport of radioactive material through Oregon and the impacts to Oregonians. We advise the governor, all of you as legislators, the congressional delegation, and also the tri-party agencies, the U.S. Department of Energy, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and also the state of Washington's Department of Ecology. Currently, our board has 20 members. We have 10 citizen seats. We have 6 legislative seats, one which needs to be filled at this time. We also have 1 seat each for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which is filled by Armand. We also have seats for the directors of the State Departments of Energy and Water Resources and a governor's representative. I looked back over the years at some of the work that we've done, and it's been substantial. In 1986, the advisory committee made a recommendation to the state of Oregon to invite liaisons with the affected tribes, and this culminated in a memorandum of understanding with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and we have worked jointly with them in support of issues of common concern. In 1988, we also conducted public hearings along the transport corridor, which was the I-84, Interstate 84 corridor out in eastern Oregon, to develop a get citizens' input and put together a comprehensive transport safety plan. This was in anticipation of shipments of transuranic waste that would be leaving Hanford and going down to the waste isolation pilot plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico. This plan was seminal to the development of a programmatic transport plan for these waste shipments and was used by the U.S. Department of Energy. And I'm very proud of that work that we did. In 1993, members of our board participated in the Tank Waste Task Force, which was a group of 27 citizens from around the Northwest who helped the negotiators, the head of the EPA, head of ecology, head of U.S. Department of Energy, negotiate the 149 single-shell tanks into legally binding milestones for cleanup. Also in the fall of 93, we participated in dialogues for the formation of the site-specific advisory board, which we now have at Hanford, a regional 32-seat board. It works by consensus. In 1995, the Oregon Office of Energy led, and our waste board led, statewide public meetings to develop Oregon's position on the disposition of surplus plutonium at Hanford. We conducted meetings in 10 cities around the state. We utilized EdNet technology to present and collect concerns of Oregonians at other sites. We also produced a final report as a culmination to this effort called the Oregon Approach. It's a grassroots method to achieve meaningful public involvement. It covers the total public involvement process, was our attempt to demonstrate a means to help define effective public involvement methods. And looking back at that document, it still stands the test of time and is a tremendous roadmap for gathering public input. And we utilize focus groups and video, getting out to civic groups to this day. Also in 1995, I was asked, along with five other people from around the nation, to go back to headquarters and help Department of Energy managers understand what it means to utilize stakeholders and set up formal functioning boards such as the Hanford Advisory Board that we have in our region. And this was a tremendous honor for me to get to do that work. We also have participated in national dialogues on cleanup. There was one in San Diego, another in Cincinnati. We've sent members down to the waste isolation pilot plant site in Carlsbad, New Mexico to take a look at that facility. It's where long-term storage will be for transuranic waste coming from all the sites around the DOE complex. We have a relationship with the Western Governors Association through the staff of Oregon Department of Energy. We also have had a relationship with the Technical Steering Panel, which dealt with the downwinder issues. And we also participated in openness workshops to see to promote the declassification of Cold War documents. None of this work would have been possible for this board without the tremendous professional staff of Oregon Office of Energy. And I cannot exclaim enough accolades for the support and the enthusiasm that they give us and the opportunities that they find for us to negotiate and work on behalf of citizens in Oregon for cleanup at Hanford. We have issues, and we have yet to meet this year and start talking about our next focus forward. But Ken spoke briefly with you about the number one priority, which are the tanks and the technical issues that need to be surmounted to get a working VIT plant. Coupled with that, for me, at very high priority, is the issue of groundwater contamination at Hanford. There are burial grounds and cribs and trenches where radionuclide contamination is many orders of magnitude higher than the drinking water standard. Specifically, I want to talk about the N area, and Ken showed you a slide with a zigzag trench. Mm-hmm. That's N Springs area, N area, along the river. It's in the northeasternmost corner of the site. The strontium levels out there are 14,700 picocuries per liter. This is the average in the groundwater at N Springs. Drinking water standard is 8 picocuries per liter. As I speak, this contamination is entering the river.
Excuse me, let me interrupt you there.
Yes.
Just to put that in context, how many times the drinking standard would that
be?
I'd just like a nice little number. We've got a mathematician here.
No, 8 picocuries per liter is the federal standard for clean water.
Okay.
And this is 14,000 picocuries per liter.
I just would like somebody to throw that out there.
The fraction is 8 over 14,000.
Yeah.
10,000 times.
10,000, good enough.
Huh? 1,000 times.
2,000
times the safe standard.
2,000 times, that sounds a little... Well, it's not reasonable. There's nothing reasonable.
It's always nice to have staff with a calculator in their hands. It's 2,800 times.
Mr. Chairman, can I point something out?
Yes.
One picocurie over the standard is a threat to human health.
Yeah, and this is 2,800 times.
Okay. So after a certain amount.
That's right.
Probably times to kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. I thought it was worth interrupting to make that point.
Thank you.
Continue.
It's entering the river, you know, as I speak. The salmon, which are unarguably the symbol of the health and the wealth of the Pacific Northwest, build their nests, their salmon reds, along those banks, off of those banks. I think our lack of focus on remediation of the end spring specifically, but also other contaminated sites within the Hanford boundary, really belies the reverence that we so easily voice in the Northwest when we speak the salmon's name, and that it's time for us to really muscle and work to get the funding necessary to do the type of technology development that's necessary to get this area cleaned up. There's been insufficient priority that's been given to the development of new technologies across the site in groundwater remediation. We seem to be waiting for off-the-shelf technology to appear, something that we can shoehorn in and fit the cleanup remediation that's necessary at Hanford. I think it's time for us to lean on the Department of Energy and aggressively employ an in-house research and development of technologies that are specific to the cleanup needs at Hanford. We lost our site technology coordination group. It was defunded at Hanford. Consequently, there's no champion for science and technology application at this point. We need an avenue to muscle that. I'd like our board to focus on the recommendations, on this recommendation to the tri-party agencies for the development of milestones that speak specifically to research and technology development to remediate groundwater. Some of the burial grounds at Hanford require the use of robotic technology in order to retrieve the buried waste. They're that hot. You can't take a backhoe in and open them up and expect someone to survive it. So it's going to take years to develop and deploy this technology. Containment of this material, once we exhume it, is going to require another facility. We're going to need a remote handled processing facility. We have yet to talk about that. We have yet to agree upon it. It is not funded. It needs to be funded. The facility is also integral to the success of our getting remote handled transuranic waste from the site down to Carlsbad, New Mexico for permanent disposition. We have to have that building. It's imperative that our government get on with it and get this facility built and get the technology up and going that's necessary to remediate all the burial grounds across site that need this. We also have the potential of losing a window of opportunity, and there are specific areas that are designated legally within the WIP facility down in Carlsbad for remote-handled transuranic waste. As that facility fills up, if we are not ready to get our waste into that facility in a timely fashion, we may lose that opportunity, and that waste will end up staying forever at Hanford. I don't want to see that happen. I believe it needs to go down to the waste isolation pilot plant. Transport of waste is a big issue through Oregon for me. Our current models, or the current model that's used by the Department of Energy to calculate the risk of transport accidents, is really based on a generic set of criteria to define highway conditions. And out in eastern Oregon, we have nothing easy about the terrain. It's complex. Its navigation is exacerbated by bad weather in the winter. Very, very difficult with the canyons and the mountain that we have surrounding my town. We really need to explore the reality of this model, accurately representing transport risk through Oregon. We need to prepare to respond for an accident. We can mention that we have hazardous material spill response teams in place, but we've got to make sure that they are ready, that they are trained, that they have the equipment that they need, and that they're funded. And I think we need to see, I imagine that we'll need a continued push to see that that happens. We also, I'd like to see us continue to push for the cessation of transport of waste through Oregon during the winter. There's no reason for these shipments to be on the road. I came through yesterday over the mountain in ice, on ice, and there were way more than a handful of truckers that weren't pulling over and chaining up, and they were sliding all over the place. And that's the story of eastern Oregon in the winter. We have to think about the elevation of risk for an accident. Also, another number that was given to me by a friend of mine who sends his guys out, who works for the Oregon Department of Transportation, is that we see 15,000 vehicles come through this area a day. Almost half of them are trucks. That's a heck of a lot of traffic. And we've got to throw that into the mix, too, when we consider transport risk. Lastly, I want to talk about the desire to see Oregon Office of Energy return to department status. They're a formidable player at the table at Hanford, and go into meetings with the Department of Ecology, the U.S. Department of Energy, and U.S. Department of EPA, and muscle their way in and work hard for us. And I would like to see, instead of them being in office, seeing them elevated once again to department status. I'm also interested in seeing our board, the Oregon Hanford Waste Board, name changed to the Oregon Hanford Cleanup Board, to keep our eye on focused on the prize, which is the cleanup of Hanford Nuclear Reservation. So I'm going to go ahead and stop so that Norma Jean can start. But if you have any questions, I'd be glad to field them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we will have some questions, but go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Norma Jean Germond. I live in Lake Oswego, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here this morning to share with Shelley all of the good news she's been telling you about how nice Hanford is. And at this point in time, I really want to tell you that the Oregon Hanford Waste Board has been, since its very inception, been very interested and committed to public outreach, that we let citizens of Oregon know what is going on at Hanford or what's not going on at Hanford, and if something isn't going right at Hanford, what might happen, which would not be good, as you know, for our citizens, for our economy, and for our environment. Our commitment goes beyond just public information. It goes for public involvement. We want citizens really to be involved in talking to the Department of Energy, to asking questions, to giving comments on what is presented to them by the three parties, as Shelley pointed out, the tri-party group. We really want Oregon citizens to grow in knowledge so that they can ask very specific key questions and be able to nail the U.S. Department of Energy to the cross. We feel very strongly that the more our citizens know, the more powerful we become. And as a board, with your help all the time, with the help of the governor, with the help of our board and our staff, we can do a lot. Oregon has become, over the years, much more powerful as an entity in dealing with Hanford. We had a long struggle, and I was in through the League of Women Voters many years ago and just beginning the process of getting Oregon's voice heard at all on any Hanford issue. And I remember sitting in meetings where it was DOE folks and our small staff and myself, and we were really trying to explain how important Hanford is to us and what it means to us. If things go wrong there, it's got to be right. It's got to be carefully done. Safety's got to be a constant issue, and we cannot make mistakes. Well, it took I think, numbers of years. And the staff grew in power. And when our Hanford Waste Board was developed, and our advisory committee that Shelley and I were on in the beginning, and we've been on it since the year one, right? It took an enormous amount of effort for staff to really get a foot in the door. And so they worked hard to be up at Hanford, to know what was going on. And there was a lot of this resistance all of the time. And finally, as time went by, we became more insistent. We demanded that they tell us what's going on and that we share, and that they have public hearings down here, which they did. And we worked so that there was a better coordination between the DOE, Department of Ecology, and EPA, and us, so that our citizens would know, be involved. And as time has gone on, we have had our staff and our members of the committee go out and speak to groups. I've got a list down here of all the groups that we have spoken to. Not all of them, but some of them, an example of them. And this past year, we spoke to about 5,000 Oregonians, and we hope that this number will increase each year, and we have that intent to do that. Let them know what's going on at Hanford. Let them know they need to be involved so that things can go right. I want to speak about our staff, as Shelley did. Our staff is small in number, but it's mighty. And over the years, their clout has grown very strong. They're experts in their field. They're very professional, they're hardworking, and they're on the job. And they and our waste board play a key role in influencing and guiding now what goes on at Hanford. We are now players, but we're not official players, which we'd like to become more official players with your resolution. An example of what has been mentioned to you about the K-basins, because how close to the river they are and how dangerous they were, it was our hydrogeologists who said, the K-basins are leaking. And the DOE said, no, they're not leaking. The water's evaporating, because there's 16 feet of water over these fuel rods, because if you got anywhere near them, you'd be zapped to death. So DOE said, denied it for quite a while, and our hydrogeologist said, no, the K-basins are leaking, because when you look at the wells around the K-basins, you're going to find a lot of uranium in there that is increasing in number, and those K-basins are leaking. Well, this really got through to us, and we pounded, our staff pounded, and the citizens in the state of Washington also pounded, because they realized, hey, you guys are right down here in Oregon. Those K-basins are leaking, and this stuff is too close to the river, and that's going to travel and get in the river. So I'm really proud of the efforts of the, I want to say, bulldogness of our staff in insisting that you've got to look at this. This is serious, and we can't let this happen. So as a result, the cave basins are being cleaned up. But it was a horrendous job, and it's something that's never been done in the world. And I'm really proud of the fact that we really started that ball rolling, and the U.S. DOE had to respond to the tremendous demand from our citizens, our staff, our waste board, and the folks in Washington. Then, as you know, there's a big issue, of course, about the tanks. And Shelley's pointed out to you a lot of the problems, and we want to tell you that right now the DOE is attempting to shortchange us again on the tanks. They're saying that they're going to try some untried, easier alternative technologies, and we don't have any depth of knowledge of what that's about, and we're starting to really push and plug on that one. And one of the ironies of this is, of course, the DOE is also thinking about changing the status of high-level waste and saying some of it's not going to be high anymore, it's low, you can put it in trenches. I thought, oh God, here we go again. So, I mean, we're into it and the fight is on and we're going to keep having to go at it. And I want to say to you also that as a legislature, you guys have been wonderful. We want you to keep being wonderful, though, and help us in getting Hanford cleaned up. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I think the It would be incumbent on me, because I'm a member of the committee, and I'd be remiss if I didn't do this, to try to put the Oregon-Hanford Waste Board into the perspective, perhaps a slightly different perspective than the two members here have done today. And that is to say that members of the Tri-Party Agreement, Oregon, which would be Washington State, the Department of Energy, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the three parties of the Hanford Agreement.
EPA.
Our parties are locked into an agreement where the citizens of Washington State have no legal standing to sue. You know, the tri-party agreement contains a prohibition against litigation. And as part of the benefit of having the Hanford nuclear facility located in Washington, for the defense jobs and long-term prospects, the tri-party agreement simply says you can't sue. Oregon citizens are not a party of the agreement, yet we have not been able to establish any legal standing, despite the fact that it's quite clear that Oregon residents have suffered consequences, radioactivity releases, higher levels of radioactive related disease and illness. We still have not been able to get any leverage against the Hanford in litigation. And whether or not we ever have standing is an open question. So it's really critical that the Oregon Hanford Waste Board's activists have been able to sort of muscle their way to the table, because citizens from Washington are precluded from doing the same kinds of things that we can do. Citizens in the rest of the basin haven't been able to get the same kind of focus that we have, as being, you know, the next nearest neighbor to the Hanford Reach on the Hanford Reservation. So the work of the committee has just absolutely been invaluable. DOE doesn't quite know how to handle this. The Department of Energy from the state of Oregon has been in charge of what I'd call the best characterization of the word, a skunk works, where a bunch of dedicated people with a real clear mission have been sort of put on the task of raising the issue of cleanup for Hanford for a whole bunch of people that really don't have an official voice in this issue. And that includes Oregon citizens that don't really have an official voice other than through the Hanford Waste Board, and citizens from Washington who are covered by the tri-party agreement and have no legal standing to litigate. So, you know, there's a role that this organization plays that's a different role than I think was anticipated when the Hanford Cleanup Board was first constituted. But it's a valuable mission, and one that I think maybe viewed over time, one of the most critical missions that citizens activists can participate in. I absolutely believe that the point that was made here today is the point that we ought to take away. If you don't remember anything else about the Hanford Waste Board or the Hanford cleanup effort or the adverse impact that that contamination has on the groundwater and the relatively ineffectual efforts that have characterized Hanford to a relatively recent period, or the relatively higher level of effort that's gone into cleanup since the effective weighing in by the Hanford Waste Board, it's this: that the only thing that moves federal agencies to act is public involvement. The only thing that's moved these folks toward cleanup has been that there are people in the state of Oregon and elsewhere that just simply won't let this dog sleep. They keep kicking the dog. And that is the value of the Hanford Waste Board, and that is the value of the citizen involvement. And the correlation between federal action on this issue and their level of involvement is 100%. It's a perfect correlation. The more noise we make, the more stuff gets not at hand. So I think that's really the value of this commission and its relationship with the Department of Energy. And that's the, in fact, that's the stated mission and role when you join the Hanford Waste Board, is that you will use your best efforts to publicize the issue, because that's what's working. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, just to sum up, Senator Farioli, you guys and the Department of Energy are the best darn dog kickers around.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, I came as a neophyte dog kicker to a committee that had 16 years of experience kicking this dog before I got there. And I'm sure they'll be kicking it long after I'm gone.
But you're a fast learner.
Well, thanks.
He's a quick study, believe me.
And I guess the other thing is, one of the things that was explained to me as a member of this board was half-life. Half-life is an interesting concept. Everybody's heard the term before.
Yeah, right.
And I hope somebody that has better technical expertise will remind me of the right numbers, but the half-life for plutonium is 250,000 years. And that I was under the impression that if you went through a half-life, that the radioactive component of the target material would have dropped to half of its radioactivity during that half-life period. And I thought, well, two half-lives, and you're out of the brush. You know, two half-lives, and it's gone. Only that is not what happens. It's only half as deadly in 250,000 years. And then the succeeding 250,000 years, it will be half as deadly, and so on and so forth. But is it 10 half-lives it takes to zero out?
At least, yeah. And it doesn't quite zero out.
It doesn't quite zero
but
out. It's still
enough.
Possibly deadly to human beings after 10 half-lives. So it's not 250,000 years, which is an idiot enough planning horizon, because we have trouble with 2 years in this building. It's 2.5 million years, which is the planning horizon to eliminate the threat from plutonium that's currently in tanks, in the groundwater, and in the ground at Hanford. And so I just wonder, you know, people think the folks that are talking about cleanup in Hanford are alarmist, or they're, you know, a little bubble off true, or they've just gotten obsessive about this thing. But I think the warnings that they're bringing to us are rational and prudent, and if we don't pay attention, we're going to pay the consequences.
Senator, I think you've brought out a very important point, that it's hard for people to understand that you just can't take a broom and a dustpan and clean up. And at Hanford, everything you do, you have to study, you have to look at to make sure, because everything's connected to everything else. And you do one thing wrong, and you can start a terrible reaction that you didn't really want to start. So we were frustrated in the beginning because things did take long, and we felt that, oh, they're studying to death. But they really weren't all the time. I mean, they really had to find out. We had to characterize what's in those tanks. We don't know, because other things have been put in the tanks, and stuff from one tank got moved to another tank, you know, kept going, and pretty soon you had these witches' brews in each tank, and you don't know what's in a tank. So it's taken a long time to figure out stuff up there, and you just don't move stuff around or do something without knowing really what you're doing. And safety of your workers, of course, and safety of the people who live in those cities around is key. I mean, you just don't want to do something that's going to mess them up, or the river, or Oregon's agriculture on that side. I mean, we're right there. So,
I do have a question, and I don't know if you ladies are the ones to answer it, or if it's somebody from the Department of Energy or who, but you talk about the fish in the reach and the fact that the groundwater has been contaminated and some of it's reached a river where the fish are spawning and so on. And I'm sure that there's ongoing monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Has the ongoing monitoring proven that there's an ever-rising level of contamination or not, number one? And number two, if we clean up the trench and if we clean up the closest facilities, and it's hard for me to keep all this straight, will the contamination at River's Edge drop down? Will it be at some point, you know, possible for us to say that the fish can spawn safely again in the Hanford Reach and so on? Can I get somebody to address that a little bit, Mike? Maybe you need to
Mike, back
over
we got the
here.
Chromium problem there.
Huh?
He's going to talk to you about the chromium problem, I think.
Mr. Chairman, there are some studies. They're not as many as we need, and they do show some levels of contamination, especially in the spawning beds. And that's been a concern, especially because of the heavier concentrations per person that the Indian tribes consume of salmon than the general population. So it's been a particular concern of the Confederated tribes. I think the issue of how much, you know, by cleaning up will you reduce this threat, I think that's our ultimate goal. There's a lot of the groundwater that's been contaminated can be intercepted, so it won't reach the river. And the river itself has a diluting effect, at least to some extent, but that's not obviously a solution. But in order to intercept that contaminated groundwater, it's going to take action by the federal government to make groundwater contamination cleanup a priority, and that has not been one of the priorities so far. That's probably been the area that's been our single biggest continuing disagreement with the U.S. Department of Energy at Hanford on is how soon they respond to groundwater cleanup. It will be very expensive, no question about it, but we think that's a critical priority for them to do.
Is the groundwater a time bomb? I mean, at some point, will a critical amount of contaminated groundwater reach the river? And at that point, do you have any scenarios that you can...
Mr. Chairman, yes. I mean, it's definitely a potential time bomb, both what's contaminated so far and what is the risk for future contamination from the tanks that we know have been leaking and the ones that haven't yet leaked, but it's just a matter of time, those other single-shell tanks. So, potentially some of the scenarios could be very grim. We have to do something to intercept the groundwater that's already been contaminated, and we have to do something to reduce the threat and eliminate the threat of additional contamination from the waste that's still in those underground tanks, because that's what's the biggest threat of contamination to most of the groundwater.
A final question, and then I'll quit. I don't want to take more than my share of time, but Senator Farioli referred to having legal standing. Just how much contamination do Oregonians have to suffer to get, I mean, you say it's mostly the tribes right now, somebody that would maybe be up there fishing or whatever, you know. What do you have to get legal standing? I mean, you got to have a certain number of people keel over. I mean, how do you get legal standing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, for litigation purposes, suing the federal government is very hard. Our lawyers have looked at this a number of times, and Senator Farioli correctly points out that under the agreement under federal law, there's a preclusion for any parties to that agreement, the tri-party agreement, for suing until the cleanup essentially is done, which is 40 years, 50 years, who knows how long. There's limited enforcement actions that can be taken, but actually suing is precluded except in very limited circumstances. It's even harder for those of us who aren't a party, and that's why getting party status, getting some type of role in the tri-party agreement is important from a legal matter, and ultimately it's important from being able to affect decisions. Because for all the work we do right now, at the end of the day, the three parties can say, well, thank you very much, and then they'll go do whatever they want. We try to make sure that doesn't happen, but it's an uphill battle. They ultimately don't have to listen to what we say.
Thank you. I'll quit asking questions for now. Though I've got a lot of them.
Mr. Chairman, truly we just touched the tip of the iceberg today. We truly have given you a 40,000-foot overflight of the Hanford Dinkley Reservation issue. Let me try and give you another, just an amplifier perhaps for the groundwater question. Only about 65 or 67 of those tanks have been confirmed to be leaking out of 177. But all but a handful were built in World War II with World War II technology and single wall construction. You know, quarter-inch sheet steel with a concrete cap. That's the construction. So there's approximately 100, maybe somewhere between 80 and 100 tanks that still are filled with liquid materials that will, in fact, release to the groundwater. That we have a 200-mile area contaminated now that's migrating to the Columbia River. And so far, the technology that we've used to try to stop that material from entering the river, it's already in the groundwater, is to build concrete slurry curtain by injecting concrete into the dado zone ahead of the spill. And by creating this dam of concrete, a sheet, a curtain, whatever you want, a barrier, to try and prevent the water from doing what water does, and that's flowing downhill. And so we're injecting, I don't know what the statistics are, it's a phenomenal, fantastic amount of slurry materials to develop this barrier, curtain, the equivalent of a saran wrap barrier, between the contaminated groundwater and the river. But, you know, I have great concerns about the technical feasibility of stopping water from flowing downhill. You know, just probably isn't going to happen. The other technology that we've used is pump and treat. And so what that consists of is if you stick a straw into a liquid pool and really vacuum out the water, what happens is that the groundwater stops flowing in the normal downhill pattern and will actually flow toward the source of reduced pressure. You know, remove the water, reduce the pressure, and groundwater flows toward the hole. That's just a hydrologic fact of life. So pump and treat is the second available technology besides building this imaginary concrete Maginot line to stop the water. So slow the water down, then pump it out, and then concentrate and evaporate. Concentrate the fines and the contaminants and evaporate the water off to reduce the volume. And now you're stuck with another waste stream. And what do we do with this waste stream that we pumped and treated? We ran back up the hill and pour it into a tank that's about ready to leak. So the absurdity of the two treatment efforts clearly show the folly of relying on available technologies, because we're thinking that these off-the-shelf technologies are going to solve the problem, and not investing on new technologies, and then actually accepting as a course of action utterly ineffectual technologies. There's no way to convince me, and I'm a layperson, so I'm sure the engineers have a different picture, that you can build a concrete wall underground by pumping concrete in and stop the flow of contaminated water into the Columbia River. But those are the mitigation measures that are currently being used today at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars to try to keep this contaminated groundwater from getting into the river. Meanwhile, we're not doing anything to pump out the liquid in the tanks that have not failed, although we're absolutely certain that they will fail. So, you know, that's the current clear and present circumstance that we have today.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late. I had my other committee earlier, and I certainly appreciate you taking the time to come and visit with us today. Also, for your persistence with the issue, because I spent more time at Hanford in 1992 than I wanted to, and I see a lot of things haven't changed since then. I was interested in your persistence, and I think, as Senator Farioli has pointed out very well, it's so critical to this. I think a lot of us have felt that for the many years that this is, you know, rather than clean up, our focus has been basically as a make-work proposal for various contractors who would rotate in from General Electric to Westinghouse to Bechtel, rather than focusing on cleaning up the contamination. I'm curious about, and if you said this earlier, any of you, I apologize again, but regarding the leaking tanks issue with the ferrocyanide, the hydrogen, and the various burps that we would have, and the concerns about that, are we still having those incidents? Are we still having burping incidents with these tanks at all, or have we corrected that problem?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, most of the chemical problems, the chemical interactions within the tanks, we have not seen those in the last few years. DOE did finally we think, adequately respond in terms of managing the internals of those tanks. We still obviously have the problems of leaking, and will continue to.
And actually, I want to give credit to Senator Wyden, because it's due in part to his putting those tanks on watch lists and elevating mm-hmm. that concern publicly. Mm-hmm. That really helped to drive us DOE to find solutions.
And just one final question, Mr. Chair. Just from your perspective in working so closely with this issue, what is your summation in terms of working with the current contractor? Do you feel that in terms of openness and things, that things have changed, not changed, in terms of information and moving, you know, forward in terms of giving the Waste Board information that you need?
Senator, one of the problems is that we do not really deal directly with contractors all the time. We're dealing with the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy has a tendency to change its management like it changes underwear. So, I mean, it's kind of an ongoing thing. You get a new manager and you're not sure. And then contractors can change underneath, and maybe Shelley has more to add to that, or Doug, or anybody.
I guess your overall flow of information, however it's filtered through.
I think that the overall flow has changed since September 11th, without a doubt. Documents on the website that were publicly derived in a public setting, some of them were pulled, and those sites shut down. And so there is a closing in and a husbanding of information that has come to pass, probably in the past 2 years, even before September 11th. The work that I do fluctuates from year to year. Sometimes I really put my nose in it. As a volunteer, I end up going to a lot more in-house meetings where the scientists and engineers are discussing application of technology. I've always felt that those meetings were very open and that I have tremendous access to information. I think that Oregon has a very special standing, though. There's tremendous respect,
I think so,
for the work that all of us do, and as stakeholders, we have access to information that other stakeholders may not. And I think that's we've earned it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Metzger, there is a better openness at our specific meetings with, for example, on the tanks. We get what I think is pretty honest information from the people who are working and managing tank operations, etc. So that's been a long time in coming, but it's better. I won't say it's perfect, because then things crop up and you say, oh, why weren't we told about that? You know, so that still happens.
Well, I appreciate your vigilance, because I think, as the Senator from John Day pointed out, it's shining a light in having constant vigilance that only makes things happen. Otherwise, it's just a lot easier to let things move to a point in which they are intractable in terms of solving the problem. So thank you for your vigilance in that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. I know we have a press conference on this coming up, and we want to get Doug Riggs up here for a public perspective. Is he here? And if he's getting seated, I myself need to excuse myself for a few minutes. We have another press conference on hunger awareness down in a press room, so I'm going to sneak down there.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your chairing at this joint committee of the Ag and Natural Resources Committee and the Land and Water Committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Riggs, when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Let me see if I can get the government computer here to work.
And for the record?
For the record, I'm Doug Riggs, here appearing with the Hanford Information Network, which is a public interest group here in Oregon. And for some reason, it does not want to work. So, no, I can't even move the cursor.
Okay, well, the technical wizards are working on why your computer's frozen up. Tell us why you came here to...
Yeah.
Tell us what you came here to tell us today.
Well, I think what we'll do is disconnect this and
start from scratch.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, Doug Riggs of the Hanford Information Network. We are a voluntary organization of members in Oregon and Washington who pay particular interest on Hanford issues. I thought I'd give you a little bit of background as Susan's trying to get the presentation ready. I have 15 years of experience in Washington, D.C., working in Capitol Hill. The last 4.5 or thereabouts, I worked for Congressman Doc Hastings as his legislative director. As you may know, Congressman Hastings represents the eastern part of Washington, stretching from the tip of the Cascades over to about Walla Walla and all the way up from the Oregon to the Canadian border. One of the major installations in his district, and certainly the most pressing problem that he had back in the 1994 through 98 time frame when I worked for him, was Hanford. One thing that has not been mentioned yet this morning is that Hanford's annual budget is $2 billion. That is 1/6 of the current Oregon budget, and by the time you guys get through with your budget cutting exercises, it might be a fifth of the budget of Oregon. So if you look at it just from a scale, operational scale, it's pretty impressive.
Well, Mr. Riggs, the budget at $2 billion per year arguably is well underfunded. Do you have any estimates of what the expenditures would have to be to bring Hanford onto some reasonable cleanup schedule?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. When I started working on Hanford issues back in 1994, 1995, the Hanford budget was about $1.1 billion. So in the space of less than a decade, it's almost doubled. And at the time, I think you would find many more people in 1994 arguing that the money was not being well spent than you'd find today. I think arguably significantly more progress is being made with the dollars that are being expended at this point in time. A lot of the problem is we just don't have any idea how much it would take. And groundwater, which is something that I think has been mentioned earlier, is a perfect example. Our group finds the lack of an effective groundwater treatment plan to be one of the biggest failings at Hanford. You know, certainly the K basins are moving along quite well. Stabilization of plutonium has moved along at quite a rapid rate. The vitrification plant construction is going quite well. But at this point, the DOE only has a plan for monitoring groundwater contamination. And I would agree with Shelley Simone, as well as with, I think, Ken Niles, that if there is one major glaring inconsistency in the stated goal of cleaning up the Hanford site, it would have to be groundwater contamination. And that's an expensive proposition. And I'm not sure anyone has a handle on the cost of that, just because we don't know what the technology would be. You mentioned a couple of technologies that have been pursued. I think that there are technologies out there that must be developed that have not yet been developed. And is that $100 million? Is that $10 billion? Is that some miracle technology that will solve the problem tomorrow? That's a very good question. I'm not sure what the answer to that question would be. Suffice it to say that the budget is very large. I mean, $2 billion a year is a significant budget. And I think it would take some time as an effort to determine what the budget should be or could be.
Okay.
I think we are about ready, so...
All right, well, let me warn you, Mr. Riggs, this committee is going to adjourn in about 7 minutes.
We'll be done by that point in time. Basically, what I wanted to show you here, Mr. Chairman, is just give you a quick series of pictures, because I've always thought a picture is worth 1,000 words. And let me see if I can actually find it here. Isn't technology grand?
No, Stanford.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think, Mr. Riggs, you're helping to illustrate why our reliance on technology to clean up Hanford has left people with less than full confidence in the outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I will note that it was the government computer that I was expecting to use that didn't work, so... believing it's worth seeing if we can ever get this thing hooked up.
Well, we're waiting for the technology. I'll point out that our staff has brought down Legislative Council Draft 2520, which I think is a committee bill for our committee, Land and Water Committee, which includes, as part of the changes, to rename the Department of Energy, rename the Office of Energy to the State Department of Energy, and also change the name of the Hanford Waste Board to the Oregon Hanford Cleanup Board. So the pieces of legislation that were requested by the folks that were testifying today for the Hanford Waste Board, in fact, are in our hopper.
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that our group, as I think most of the groups in Oregon, will be supportive of that type of an effort. Okay. Lights, camera, action.
This Mr. Riggs better be worth the wait.
That's right. That's it. The whole presentation.
5 minutes.
That's right. I've been asked to make a couple comments about Hanford, and I just wanted to make a few points quickly before I get into the public role. I think we've talked about the background. I think it's important to understand from a public perspective that the entire history of Hanford was above top secret.
Right.
I mean, the workers at the time didn't know what they were working on. And there, I think a gradual evolution on the public role has taken place on this situation. When I started in 1995, most of the employees had been around for 20, 25, 30, 35 years. They'd grown up in that culture of secrecy. They had been told, it had been ingrained in their training, don't share, don't talk about things, be secretive. I mean, that was, we were in the Cold War and World War II, and I think that was understandable. So I think certainly the public was demanding more openness, and it took a while to get it. What has changed, in my mind, the most important thing that changed, when I worked for Congressman Hastings, one of the things that we thought was very important was to see a number of the older generation of workers retire so we could bring in new folks. Partly that was because the older people tended to be nuclear production engineers. They didn't have skills for environmental cleanup. And the other issue that we thought was very important was that they weren't effective public communicators. And so I think in the last 4 or 5 years, what we've seen is a whole new group of people who've come in who've been more open to public processes. Important question about why we care. You know, a picture says 1,000 words. Hanford is a beautiful, majestic, wonderful location. And it's located right along the Columbia River. So the impact, arguably, on Oregon would be greater than Washington. We talked about the Columbia River. It's a long history of public involvement here, and we've got a very active group of citizens. And if you look behind me, you'll see a number of them who've spent quite a bit of their time. I want to give you a couple examples of progress, because I think one of the reasons that I see people getting excited again about getting involved in Hanford is that we have seen that some positive things are happening. The first is one that Mike and Ken have gone into earlier, and I won't belabor the point, but suffice it to say that it's a tremendous accomplishment to get half of the fuel out of one of those K-basins. That's excellent news. The river shore cleanup, although there's much left to do, obviously we've made some significant progress. 3 million cubic yards have been removed. And another significant issue that the chairman has touched on today is the single shell tanks. There are 148 single shell tanks. I believe we've drained the liquid out of 128 of those 144 single shell tanks. So significant progress has been made. And those are the tanks that are the most compromised. And plutonium is being stabilized. A couple pictures. I said a picture is worth 1,000 words. 1 year ago, the site on which the vitrification plant would be located looked like this. Today, as of last week, it looks like this. And if you look around, you can see a tremendous amount of progress. I mean, this is a large area. And if you look carefully, which you can do, or I could bring a better picture to you, I mean, you can see a variety of facilities and buildings going up. This is progress that we never would have seen 4 or 5 years ago. And just a couple more pictures of the ongoing construction, so fairly significant. Public involvement comes in a number of ways, and I'm sure I've only touched on a handful of them here. There are public opportunities for people to participate in public meetings. They can belong to a variety of groups. There are other avenues such as OMSI, which I'll talk about down the road. The Oregon Office of Energy and our group goes out and talks to schools. We've had displays at malls. We've looked for opportunities for large audiences, and of course there's the media. We go through these in a series of issues. public meetings are perhaps one of the best opportunities for people in the public to get a sense about what's going on with Hanford. And we've got a variety of opportunities here. But you can see Paige Knight in the lower right-hand column testifying at one of the meetings, very involved with Hanford Watch. Rob Davis, our chairman, testifying in one of the other public meetings. Membership in groups. We have a large number of groups in the state. The largest, probably the most active, has been Hanford Watch. Paige Knight is the president of Hanford Watch, very active. Columbia Riverkeeper, which is based in Hood River, has also been very active on the issues. We've been around for about 5 years now and attend meetings, work with a variety of schools. You have PSR, which has been active, Hanford Action, and Heart of America, all of which have an involvement in Oregon. Other avenues include the Hanford Waste Board, which we've talked about, the Hanford Advisory Board. At a federal level, we used to have representation on the Environmental Management Advisory Board. We no longer do. And then we have a legislative process both here and in D.C. I want to talk about just a couple quick things. I really believe one of your comments, and I wrote it down at the beginning, Mr. Chair, this is an attempt to get the word out to yet another generation of Oregonians, and I think that's very important. We have adopted an effort to get out to school groups, and we've been to a number of schools throughout the Northwest, talked specifically to 41 classes and 1,500-plus kids in the last year alone, and we'll probably double that by this time next year. Good opportunity. Public displays in malls, at fairs, at community workshops, another good opportunity to let people know what's going on.
Mr. Riggs, I'm going to bring your testimony to conclusion by inviting people to communicate with the Hanford Information Network at P.O. Box 230300 in Portland, 97281, or contact your group on AOL, which email address is cleanupnorthwest@aol.com. That's cleanupnw@aol.com. And that'll put it on the record for those that are listening on the Internet. This morning we have an opportunity to further communicate this message with Oregonians, and it'll be down in hearing room or room 35, which is the Legislative Media Center. So I'm going to ask folks to go ahead at the conclusion of today's hearing and join me and others in room 35 to take this message to more people in the state of Oregon. I'm going to ask if the committee has any questions for Mr. Rigg. Yes.
Mr. Chair, is the miniature CD you gave us the same thing we're seeing here?
No, it's the CD that I gave you is a CD that outlines the purposes and the exhibit at the OMSI Museum, which I would have talked about later in the presentation. It's about a 5-minute
I'll ask members of the committee to view that CD at their leisure. And if there are no further questions for Mr. Riggs, what I'm going to do is conclude today's public hearing with the reminder that we will be receiving at the President's desk today Senate Memorial Number 1, which is to urge Congress to fully fund cleanup at Hanford. And also, I want to thank Anton Minthorn from the Confederated Tribes for his testimony, members of the Hanford Waste Board for their testimony, Mr. Riggs and others, and to suggest to you that this is a story that needs to be told often and thought about a great deal. I want to thank members of the committee for indulging us with a joint legislative hearing for both the Natural Resource Committee and the Land and Water Committee. And with that, we're in adjournment.